Thank you, Al. Well, this morning, get to try to one more time at this for Dr. Jones, but we just like to. We heard from her last night. She did an awesome job as far as speaking about women's issues and health. And today, we'd like to welcome her back, and she's going to speak about polycystic ovarian disease, current day chicanery. Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, you need to know that chicanery was not my choice. If you had to pick the organizers of this organization, the person who you might think have used that word, you would probably be right if it was Al. So Al wanted me to use this word on a discussion about PCOS. But I don't really like that word because chicanery means the use of trickery to achieve a political or financial or legal purpose. And so in the domain of polycystic ovary syndrome, I didn't really want to talk about it that way. The synonyms include underhandedness and duplicity and fraud. And in fact, PCOS is a pretty simple problem, and I want to treat it simply and not get sidetracked. That's what I'm going to ask you to do, is not get sidetracked by a lot of contemporary laboratories and imaging and things which really do not help you with the patient. So I renamed it AL, sorry. Instead of modern day chicanery, I called it It Isn't That Hard. Now, let's talk a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about androgen disorders in women. So women who complain of excess hair growth or, you know, temporal balding, that's the main sign of excess androgens in women. I'm going to talk a little bit about cost-effective workup for polycystic ovary syndrome, and I'm going to give some evidence-based recommendations in terms of both androgens and some things about diet and obesity. Luckily, you're having another talk on weight loss, which is going to be very important in PCOS. My disclosures, I have no financial disclosures, but I will be talking about the use of birth control pills in an off-label purpose. Well, so when a newborn girl is born, when she's a newborn, she has all the eggs that she's ever going to have, and we can't tell by looking at her as a newborn that she will actually be the one of the one in ten women in this country with polycystic ovary syndrome. So why do I talk about a quote-unquote endocrine problem, the most common endocrine problem in this country, to a group of generalists, because maybe you're not endocrinologists and you're not necessarily OBGYNs? Well, this is so common that every one of you knows someone who probably manifests the symptoms of PCOS, and maybe they've been given the diagnosis and maybe they haven't. Now, if you look at this little girl, you can't tell as you're up close, but she's kind of fuzzy, but that's just newborns. So newborns are covered with lanugo hair, and it's a little important that when people come to who complain of hair growth, that the fuzzy little hair that all women have on their faces and arms, some women more than others, when we talk about the hair growth that might be manifested in PCOS, we're talking about coarse, more male pattern hair. I'm going to start briefly with a little story. When I was a chief resident at the Lying-In Hospital, the Brigham and Women's Hospital's former home at Harvard in Boston, a woman came in who was pregnant and had hypertension. And I could not get her to stay in the hospital because she really needed to be hospitalized. She was still early in her pregnancy at about 32 weeks, and she wouldn't stay. And I sat down and I said, I really would like to understand how we can help you and your baby and why you won't stay. And she said, well, I have to shave every day, and I don't know if this is I won't have a private bathroom and a private room, and I don't want anybody to see me do this. And the story was this. She was a pathologically shy young woman who lived with her mother, who fed her whatever she wanted to eat. She had a period, her first period, when she was about 13, when she was a big girl. She was overweight, and then she became morbidly obese. She never left her home. So she became morbidly obese. She weighed about 400 pounds. And over time, she developed hair growth enough that she needed to shave every day. She actually was a shut-in, and then her mother died when she was about 32. And when her mother died, she didn't go out, and she essentially starved. And when she finally went out, she had lost about 200 pounds. And she was still shaving, but she had the second period in her life with her weight loss. So by definition, she had polycystic ovary syndrome, but she subsequently, with weight loss, had her first period, then she had her second period, she went out, she got married, and she immediately became pregnant. And this is the daughter that she bore, who is at risk for polycystic ovary syndrome, because it has an inherited pattern, but it isn't a gene that we can follow. So here is a woman who had two periods in her life, the one that she had when she was 13, the one she had just before she got married. She has polycystic ovary syndrome by definition, meaning she was obese and she had androgen excess syndrome, but through the unfortunate circumstances of her mother's death, she lost weight and became fertile and led essentially a pretty normal life except for her hypertension. So let's talk a little bit more about, if I can make this change. Let's go forward. Can we go forward? Or maybe I need a new battery, because it's not. Well, she's a cute little girl, but we don't want to look at her all day long. So while we're thinking about going forward, so it turns out that the majority of people with true PCOS manifest this condition at adolescence. So as you take a look, what we find is that LH is suppressed in the pituitary. I know this is taking you back to medical school and you don't want to, but at puberty, LH rises, and in normal puberty, you have spikes of LH to recruit one egg of the hundreds of eggs that want to run the race. Hundreds of eggs run the race in young women to become the one dominant follicle to ovulate. If circumstances happen where a lot of the eggs are at the same little stage, small follicles, small eggs, make male hormones. You have to get big enough as a follicle, you have to get about an inch before you actually start making estrogens. And if eggs get stuck in that stage where they're small, and a half an inch to an inch, they make male hormones. And when you're involved in an area where there are too many male hormones, you can't ovulate. If you give women male hormones to become transgendered, they will develop polycystic ovary syndrome. So when you are an adolescent, you start off with all these eggs running the race. And if you look at the ovaries of young women, even young women are having normal periods, they have many, many eggs in there. And all those little eggs are making male hormones, which is why acne is pretty common in adolescence, and so are irregular periods, even though they don't have polycystic ovaries. So about 20% of women in their lifetime experience abnormal bleeding in irregular periods. And most of it happens within the first 2 to 3 years after puberty. About 83% of cycles are naturally anovulatory. So in adolescence, early adolescence, they have acne, and they don't usually have that much hair growth problems, but they have acne, which is a sign of androgen excess, and they have irregular periods. So by definition, you would say that those young women have polycystic ovary syndrome, and they don't. They're just young. Now, a little key for you, for adolescents who have not established a 24 to 35-day cycle by 3 years into after menarche, they will probably have a lifelong pattern of being irregular. So it takes about 3 years for young women to get themselves all caught up. So why are adolescents, and remember, most people with PCO, not all, but most people with polycystic ovary syndromes, ovary with a lot of little eggs stuck in development that make male hormones, usually this begins at puberty. So it could be that the brain just isn't awake enough to actually send out the right messages to recruit an egg. We see it sometimes in sports participation. I've been a consultant to the Olympic Ski Committee, and you see kids, particularly kids who are in very demanding sports physically, often have irregular periods. And you might say, well, they have PCOS. So I get consulted all the time for women who were said that they were in PCOS because their periods were irregular, and they were not. They didn't have any evidence of androgen excess. They were just working out really hard. So we know that stress and eating disorders and a lot of physical activity in sports, and some endocrine disorders, which include hypothyroidism. So this is all in the differential diagnosis of irregular periods. So it's important that you know that not all irregular periods are polycystic ovary syndrome. Irregular periods in early teenhood is common, such that I don't even work it up until it's been more than 3 years. I don't work up irregular periods until it's been at least 3 years. I work up menorrhagia, so if someone's been in the hospital a couple times for heavy bleeding and they're anemic, then I might work them up for anemia and menorrhagia. But I don't really work up kids until it's been at least 3 years. So PCOS is a syndrome. It's not a disease. So there's not one disease entity. It's a syndrome, which we'll talk about the debate about how you define this syndrome, but 5 to 10% of women have this problem. That's pretty common, so it's about 1 in 10 to 1 in 20. Being overweight is common, but not necessary. It's one of the most least manageable, but most manageable symptoms, and most important to manage is the being overweight. About 17% of thin women with polycystic ovary disease and 50% of obese women with PCOS are insulin resistant. But that doesn't mean they're diabetic. In fact, the vast majority of them are not diabetic. Some of them actually have acanthosis nigricans, that brownish tinge to skin in areas that wrinkle. So you can see it. I usually can see it right on their knuckles when they're talking to me. This is a diagnosis that I make walking down the hall or walking down the street. I can make the diagnosis of PCOS by the time someone just walks in my clinic before they take their clothes off. Because of the physiognomy, the way weight is distributed, particularly if they have a little darkening of their skin over their knuckles, acanthosis. And hirsutism. Hirsutism actually develops a little later than acne in kids, but acne is not at all uncommon. So most women with polycystic ovary syndrome have been anovulatory since puberty. They usually have less than 6 periods a year. Their periods are unpredictable in amount and timing. Excessive hair growth is sort of typical, although that you may not notice until women are in their 20s or 30s, because it takes a long time to recruit a male hair. So adolescents often don't have that much extra hair growth, and you may not see it on their face. Right now, you don't see hair on women anywhere anymore. It used to be that I could take women's clothes off and I could see the hair pattern, but now nobody has any hair anywhere. So it's not on their face, and it's not on their armpits, and it's not on their abdomen, and it's not anywhere else. So as an endocrinologist, I usually have to say, do you shave your hair? And they say, oh, sure, yeah. And I say, well, do you ever shave some of your facial hair? Yeah, I do that, and that's can be helpful. Most of these women are infertile, but not all. So it's important I've had lots of babies named after me, because I said, oh, you probably aren't going to get pregnant, and then they ovulated and got pregnant. So for women with PCOS who don't want to get pregnant, they need contraception. They are at risk for diabetes, because about 50% of them are insulin resistant as young, but there's debate as whether they're really at increased risk for heart disease. So when you Google, make the mistake of Googling PCOS, or if you're the mother of it, the kid does, or a woman does, you will be led to a heartbreaking list of symptoms that will make the mother panicked and become rushing to your clinic if you're a generalist, a pediatrician, an OBGYN, an internist. So the prevalence seems to be about the same range among all races looked at to date. So it's not particularly a white woman's disease. It's a little more prevalent in populations where insulin resistance is common. So that would be Hispanic and Native Americans. And once again, depending on what definition you use, it's between 5 and 10% of the population. So let's talk about what are the criteria for PCOS. And most people like to use what we call the Rotterdam criteria, except it's really kind of confusing. And this article came out last year, and Jezebel, you may not be able to read it, but PCOS is a bad term for what the problem is. It's chronic androgenized anovulation, but chronic AO is not going to really go that far as a great term, but most people don't like the term and they don't like the diagnosis. So the Rotterdam criteria for this common endocrinopathy is you need 2 of the following 3 things. irregular menstrual periods, evidence of androgen excess, meaning acne, hirsutism, or polycystic ovaries on ultrasound. This was a not very consensus between the Europeans that really like using ultrasound and the Americans who really don't. And I'm here to say I really don't like using ultrasound in part of the diagnostic tool for PCOS, because if you look at young women, they all have polycystic ovaries. They all have tons of eggs there. So what you have is the intersection between irregular periods, which are common in adolescence. You have hirsutism, which is not too common, but there are a bunch of other things that can cause that. And polycystic ovaries, which in young women are very common just because they have lots of eggs. So this has been the worldwide criteria. You need two of those three things to make the diagnosis. It's a clinical diagnosis. It's not a laboratory diagnosis. It's not a genetic diagnosis. It's a clinical diagnosis. So there was very little consensus in this consensus conference, and it really fell down over the issue of ultrasound. So we're left with diagnostic criteria, which are mostly clinical, irregular periods, and androgen excess. Very common. So what is the ultrasound criteria? Well, you need more than 12 follicles that are 2 to 9 millimeters. So these are little follicles. And you need increased volume of the ovary. So the ovary's got to be kind of plump. Well, once again, all of our egg donors that we use at the University of Utah in our IVF program, very fertile women with great eggs, have these criteria by definition. So using this definition, and if you get an ultrasound, your radiologist will say polycystic appearing ovaries. Well, if a woman's having perfectly regular period, she now has an ultrasound with a diagnostic, I think, disease on it, which they don't really have. So I never use ultrasound in the evaluation of polycystic ovary syndrome. A, it's a little bit expensive, and I don't need it. And I don't need it because we've moved on. This is what it can look like on ultrasound. All these little follicles all kind of ranged together on the outside, because all the eggs are at the outside of the ovary. And little follicles make male hormones. Great big ones, the dominant follicle, make estrogens. So only 2 out of 3 women who have ovaries that look like this really have polycystic ovary syndrome. And about 25% of ovulatory women have ovaries look like this. So when you're seeing someone who thinks they might have polycystic ovaries and they want an ultrasound, I don't think it's helpful, and I think you should save money. Now, many doctors use it to make money. So many OBGYNs, ultrasound, they have ultrasounds in their office, and they use it all the time, and so they do a transvaginal scan, and they look at the ovaries. But it's not, as an endocrinologist, a reproductive endocrinologist, I do not use ovarian ultrasound. So it turns out that you can have all these little follicles. They make high male hormones, which can be part of both the anovulation, because if you're trying to grow in an environment where there are lots of male hormones, you don't get big. You get stuck in development. So many follicles actually just demonstrates that they're young and they have good ovarian reserve. So I usually, when someone comes with irregular periods and evidence of androgen excess, I look for some very basic other causes of irregular periods, and I do the cheap workup. So if you use the ultrasound, the Rotterdam criteria, you'll find that 61% of women who are 25 to 30 will have PCOS by the Rotterdam criteria. And just not that many people have PCOS. And women get freaked out if they're told that they have polycystic ovaries. So I'm going to try to convince you not to use ultrasound. So there was another consensus conference in 2008 that said, well, we don't have any consensus about this diagnosis, so let's stick with what we know. It's not obesity, the Stein-Leventhal syndrome that some of you were raised to understand, that it was obesity, hirsutism, and irregular periods. Obesity isn't necessarily part of the symptom. So in 2008, they said you need two things, and you have to have both of them. You have to have irregular periods or anovulation, although sometimes they ovulate, and you need evidence of androgen excess, which would be acne, hair growth. But remember, not all women with acne and hair growth have polycystic ovaries, and not all women, depending on their ethnic background, are very hirsute. So Asian women, it takes a lot of androgens to make an Asian, even an Asian male, hairy. So Asians don't get very hairy, no matter how much androgens they have. So there are clinical and biochemical signs of androgen excess in women, and so it you may notice that it's here on the lower abdomen, but not everybody has it, and some people shave it, and some people who are Mediterranean have hair on their lower tummy, and they have perfectly regular periods. So if an adolescent doesn't have hyperandrogenism, and they have irregular periods, I don't order an ultrasound. And remember, I almost never order an ultrasound for irregular periods. So the diagnostic approach in adolescence, remembering that that's often when women present in adolescence. Their mothers bring them in because they have irregular periods. So I avoid the numerous blood tests. I see women referred to me who have had probably $1,000 worth of evaluations for something that I could make the diagnosis when they walked in the room, because they were kind of apple-shaped. They maybe had some thinning hair on top, they had a little bit of acne, and they had irregular periods. I can't usually tell that by looking at people whether their periods are irregular, though. But I can tell the other stuff. So PCOS makes the big chunk of people who have both irregular periods and androgen excess. So androgen excess disorders, other than PCOS, are really kind of rare. So you have Cushing's syndrome, which is pretty rare. I've made one diagnosis in my career of Cushing's syndrome in someone who came in with irregular periods and hirsutism. And tumors, androgen-producing tumors, and I've made one diagnosis of those in my career. And there's non-classical adrenal hyperplasia, but that's not very common, and we treat mostly women with non-classical congenital adrenal hyperplasia. People just have a mild defect in their gene that makes the pathway to cortisol. We treat them the same as PCO patients anyway, mostly. So the kinds of things that are in the differential are mostly pretty rare. So the million-dollar workup includes the following: a thyroid, prolactin, free testosterone, sex hormone binding globulin, androstenedione. You can read the whole bunch of things there, and a fasting glucose, and an ultrasound. That's the million-dollar workup for something that probably shouldn't cost more than $100. So you get all this stuff. I think I don't even measure serum androgens unless someone is really virilized. If someone has a full beard, has lowered their voice, they have a lot of symptoms of androgen excess, temporal balding, then I'm worried about a tumor. And so in that case, I'll order a testosterone. But in women who have a little bit of acne, a little bit of extra hair growth, I can see the androgens on their body. I don't really need to order a blood test. So I don't order serum androgens all that often. So if you're worried someone's rapidly virilizing, then it might be worthwhile getting androgens. Non-classical adrenal hyperplasia, well, how many of you have seen this in your career, non-classical adult onset adrenal hyperplasia? I don't see any hands. So it's probably a little more common than you think. It's 1 in 100 in New York City, but that's because New York City has Hispanics, Mediterranean, Ashkenazi Jews. But in Salt Lake and in Utah, it's pretty rare, and I think I've made the diagnosis twice. So I only order androgens if I think someone's rapidly virilizing, rapidly getting very hirsute. Cushing syndrome, so how many of you guys have made a diagnosis of Cushing syndrome? Somebody must have, one. So someone who is obese, has stria, buffalo hump, weakness, a relatively new onset. That's worth working up. And this is all in the disc, you can Google the workup for Cushing's disease, so I don't need to go through it with you today. But I rarely do that unless someone comes in with all the stigmata of Cushing's disease. The $100 workup. I get a testosterone if someone's really hirsute and has a lot of acne. I get a prolactin, because that's the workup for irregular periods, and you would treat that differently if they have a pituitary tumor. And a thyroid, because hypothyroidism can lead to irregular periods. So there you're talking about, well, it's more than 100, maybe it's $200. I only get a serum glucose if I'm clinically have a suspicion that they might have diabetes. So they're having some symptoms of polyuria, polydipsia. So I don't usually get a serum glucose, but there are recommendations to get serum glucose or hemoglobin A1C in women as they approach in midlife, but I rarely get a serum glucose. In the face of clinical suspicion, I would work them up for either tumor or Cushing's disease, but that is pretty uncommon. So what's this insulin resistant stuff? Not all people with PCOS have insulin resistant. It's about 50% of obese teens and only 17% of normal weight teens with PCOS. Frank diabetes is very uncommon. Diet and exercise is going to be important for any chubby adolescent, so lifestyle modification is particularly important in women with PCOS because it modifies, it lowers their androgen, it improves their self-esteem, and will make them more fertile later. I don't give them metformin. That became a big thing. Have any of you treat PCOS patients with metformin in your career? A few of you. More of you than have made the diagnosis of Cushing's disease and adrenal tumor, so that's good. I don't give it to women unless maybe they're thinking about trying to get pregnant. So I don't think you need to treat them with metformin. It doesn't treat the disease. It does make them a little less insulin resistant. So you can do PCOS the complicated way, which is the big workup, big therapy, and add birth control pills if you're not getting people to ovulate regularly and repeat it all every year. That becomes very expensive. Or you can do it the simple way, which for me is I do lifestyle modification. I give them birth control pills if they're not trying to get pregnant. And in fact, even if they are trying to get pregnant, a recent study that was just published says that women who are just put on clomiphene to help them ovulate, or another drug called letrozole, which can help them ovulate, versus women who are told to wait 6 months and go on birth control pills, modify their lifestyle, lose weight, and who was the most likely to get pregnant when they finally started to try to get pregnant, it was the lifestyle modification and birth control pill group were more likely to get pregnant and stay pregnant. So diet and exercise, birth control pills, and I check a fasting glucose if I think they might have diabetes. It's cheap, it's easy, and it's not scary. The goal for the treatment of polycystic ovary syndrome is to treat symptoms. So to prevent anovulatory bleeding, to suppress androgens to get for cosmetic purposes, and be prepared to treat diabetes if someone continues to lose weight. I use low-dose birth control pills as the hallmark and of my treatment because low-dose birth control pills will not only suppress those little follicles, it will lower androgens, it will decrease the acne and the hair growth, and it works pretty well if someone's not trying to get pregnant in modifying most of the symptoms. For people who have had a blood clot or they can't take OCPs, they need progestins to clean out their lining every couple months. And that's cheap and easy. If they still have a lot of evidence of androgen excess, you can use something like spironolactone at 50 milligrams, and that can be helpful. Now, what do you use for the hair growth? Well, I use birth control pills, and that's my number one go-to. Laser for hair, and I can't say that I've used eflornithine, then. I don't know if any of you guys have used eflornithine, which is a cream that is blocks a sort of hair growth. Any of you use eflornithine? A couple of you. So I think you can use that, but mostly I get where I want to go with birth control pills. So let's talk briefly about obesity, from then I'm going to finish up. So the incidence of obesity is increasing, and obesity and PCOS interlap. So people who are obese can have irregular periods, but they don't necessarily have androgen excess. So there is the intersection of obesity and PCOS. Now, what kind of a diet do I recommend? And you're going to have another talk in about an hour on diet. There's some evidence that a low-carb diet is the best choice for adult women and adolescents. The A to Z study, which was published in the New England Journal, looked at the Atkins diet, they looked at the Zone diet, the Ornish diet, and what I call the Weight Watchers, or the lifestyle modification diet. And if you take a look here, it was published in JAMA here, but it was published several places. The Learn diet includes lifestyle modification and diet and exercise and thinking more about your eating. So this was a randomized study. And here's what you got. Now, you guys can't see it all that well, but you can see that here's weight loss. All weight loss of the top four groups are the Zone and the Learn and the Ornish. The one that actually was the best is the one at the bottom where people lost the most weight was the Atkins diet. So we have data that says that a low-carb diet is probably the best for weight loss in this group. It also is the best for people who are insulin resistant. And it's probably the best in terms of mood, because there's been some study that looked at the Atkins diet and mood in PCO patients and found that they were a little happier. Exercise, good luck with recommending exercise, but it's really helpful in terms of, it's not going to make people lose weight, you have to diet to lose weight, but it does help them with their mood and can help them with their confidence. So bariatric surgery, I've recommended a handful of times, and it's probably the most successful of all options in the morbidly obese adolescent with PCO. Another study actually looked at, were randomized to the various diets, and they found that for some reason the low-carb, high-protein diet had less depression. And depression is a part of polycystic ovary syndrome. So rather than making the million-dollar workup, I think you should be thinking about how to treat symptoms. When you're talking about adolescents, you're thinking about managing their weight and managing their irregular bleeding. And so you're really thinking about birth control pills and lifestyle modification. If you're thinking about a woman who's trying to get pregnant, then you're going to be offering them something for ovulation induction. But starting with birth control pills and weight loss makes them more likely to be successful when you finally give them medicine to help them ovulate. And when, as you get older, you're thinking about the obese woman who might be at risk for more for heart disease and diabetes, and then you would treat them like all your patients, because heart disease and risk factors for heart disease are common in older women. So for all of these, this is just a picture I saw of adolescents, and you can see a lot of these, some of these adolescent girls are kind of skinny, but some of them are already kind of chunky. And so chunkiness in an adolescent and irregular periods with any signs of androgen excess, and they may have polycystic ovaries, or they may just be the average American adolescent who just hasn't got her pattern started yet. So I think the name is going to change and the definitions are going to change, but it isn't that hard. If they're irregular, have irregular periods, if they have evidence of androgen excess, and they aren't within the first 3 years of menarche, then they probably have polycystic ovaries. Work out something, we'll get thyroid, get a prolactin, maybe get a testosterone if their androgens are really looking high, meaning they really have a lot of hirsutism, particularly if they have chest hair or they have evidence of virilization. And birth control pills are still the first line therapy. Metformin can help some women with ovulation and when added to clomiphene, but weight management is really important. And so it's not chicanery, it's really pretty simple. It's pretty frustrating for the patient, but there are lots of things to make them healthier and happier, and we can do that for all of you who take care of women. Thank you. I'd be happy to take any questions. I know we want to stay on time, but, and I'm around, so I'll be around all day, so I'm more than happy to answer questions as you go along. One question, two questions.
Yeah, I have a question. So you say you put them on birth control pills. What if they don't mind not having a period? Is that dangerous? Do you have to do it once a year?
Yeah, no, not once a year. So it turns out that young women with polycystic ovary syndrome are at significant higher risk of uterine cancer. So if they don't have a progestin withdrawal, that hormonal DNC that we do every month, if they don't have that, they're at risk for uncontrolled vaginal bleeding, and they're at slightly increased risk for uterine cancer, certainly as they get older and longer that they've had unopposed estrogens. So I tell them they need that hormonal DNC. Birth control pills will lower their male hormones, will give them predictable periods. So not having periods, a woman probably needs to shed her endometrium if she's got estrogens around. So when you're breastfeeding, you don't have estrogens around. So it's okay not to have a period. But these women make a lot of estrogens because their fat cells convert male hormones to female hormones. So they need to shed their cycle, their lining, at least every other month.
So that is the treatment then, okay.
Right.
The other question is, if they lose weight and they start having periods independently on their own, are they cured or in remission? Or
no. Well, they're cured in the sense that they no longer have, they may still have androgen excess, but they don't have irregular periods. So they're cured, but we all know that women who lose weight can gain weight back. I'm a living testimony testament to the diets that come and go in my life for the last 60 years. So I think they are sort of cured in the sense I've seen women who, when they were slender adolescents, had regular periods. They gained a lot of weight with their first pregnancy. They started being irregular in hair growth, and then they lost weight back to their regular weight that they had before they got their first baby, and they are then cured. Most people are not cured. They actually are in remission, I would call that. And weight gain will put them back in the same boat again. One quick question, yeah.
Sorry, but the recommendation for a long time was to be on metformin 1,500 milligrams, and I've seen it up to 2,000 milligrams, and I work in an OB-GYN office, and I know that some patients have been transferred to me from endocrinology to just kind of assimilate back into the regular routine. But you recommended no metformin. Was that just for adolescents?
No. I mean, if someone isn't overtly diabetic, so why do you take the metformin? You take the metformin, it's a way of getting some women to have regular cycles, and it's a way of decreasing androgens a little bit. So insulin makes the ovaries make more male hormones, just happens to be. So insulin-resistant people make a little bit more male hormones. But I can do it for... I can do it with birth control pills, and then that also helps me with contraception and cycle control. So giving people who are not diabetic a metformin, who aren't trying to get pregnant, that would not be my goal. Now, if someone says, I want to take it because I looked it up at Google, okay, fine. But it doesn't really help people lose weight. It does have some risks. Once, it's not always easy to start. People don't feel that great. So if someone likes it and they're doing well and they're having regular periods, and their male hormones are under control, so fine. But it's not something that I would consider a long-term goal. That's been one of the mistakes, is to put everybody on really high doses of metformin. Thank you all, and I'm around for questions.